This is Clive Pearson, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 2nd of May 2012. Clive Pearson, Part 1.
My name is Clive William Pearson, and I was born in Dartmouth in South Devon on the 12th of March 1935.
So how old are you now?
77.
Okay. And just to explain, we're recording this in the same room as your marvellous machine that gives you enough air and oxygen to live by. Yeah,
that's correct. Unfortunately, yes.
So you've not moved far in your life, have you?
Well, as far as Dartmouth's concerned, I've lived within 100 yards of where I was born. I was born in 179. I was brought up in 169, which is five doors down. And I bought my present house, which is on the opposite side of the road, but differently numbered, 132, in 1974. And the whole lot is within 100 yards radius of each. So, as far as Dartmouth's concerned, I haven't really moved.
And this is all in Victoria Road?
All in Victoria Road, yeah.
In Dartmouth?
Yeah.
Tell me about your parents, Clive.
Well, my father came to Dartmouth in 1916 with his father, who was a chef on the Great Western Railway. And they came here from Liverpool because they were paying a better rate of pay on the railway down here because they were running hospital trains. And conditions apparently up where he had been left a lot to be desired. So he brought the whole family down from Liverpool. There were 10 children and grandma. And my mother was brought here under rather adverse circumstances. Her father was an ostler in London. And she was born in 1908. And in 1912, her mother had just had another child. And she died of milk fever. And in the meantime, a horse rolled against her husband, or beg your pardon, her husband, that's right, my mum's father, and broke his legs. So the children were deemed as orphans. And they were sent to Dartmouth to be with outreach family members. And the tiny baby went with his grandmother on granddad's side. And mum went with her great aunt. And the other sister, she went with some family in Didisham, which is a little village 3 miles up the river. And they were never, ever again until her brother and my mother were stood at the bottom of her bed just before she died in Dartmouth Hospital many years later. It was quite sad, really. But all us children, apart from myself, were all born at 169, and there were 8 of us in my personal family. And as I say, Dad was, for trade, he was a plumber, hot water fitter, and sanitary engineer. And he learnt his trade locally with a local tradesman and spent his working life on maintenance at Britannia Royal Naval College, except during the war where he went away doing sneaky-beaky things and then came back afterwards to clear up the mess that the Americans and the others had left behind when they left.
Tell me about your education, Clive.
Went to infant school. I can remember first day at school. Went in, it would be about very, very early 1940, because I was born 35, started at 5, first term after Easter. And when it came round to the mid-morning break, when you had your milk, said to my teacher, I can see it now as plain as anything, said, you can go now. And I came home. I didn't just go for a wee and a bottle of milk. I came home. I can't remember whether my mum walked me back again after lunch or not, but anyway, I went to infant school for a couple of years. Then I went to a school which was a few hundred yards, 200 yards further up the road from where I've always lived. That was the boys' school. And we were there as the boys' school until the local infants and girls' school was damaged by an enemy action. And then we did one week mornings with the boys and 1 week afternoons with the girls until we did a week about until the school was in a fit state to be used. And then shortly after that, the whole lot became co-ed. I did that until I was 11 plus, passed my exams and went on to Dartmouth Grammar. And I was Dartmouth Grammar from 11 plus to 15. And I went from there to South Devon Technical College. But in the meantime, And rather than take woodwork, I took catering, being influenced by my grandfather. And I went to cookery classes with the girls. And one of the girls in the cookery classes was over happy with the domestic science teacher. So she did my place in the woodwork classes. And this came out on the national press because it was quite a novelty in the mid-40s, like say, or late-40s. And I came away from South Devon Tech in 1952 with City and Guilds in cooking, waiting and hotel management. Worked in a holiday camp for a season and worked in a small private hotel in Sidmouth. And then I was called up for the services and I went in the army because if you went in for 3 years, you could go where you wished. But if you went in for 2 years as national service, you went where the services wanted to put you. So I did 3 years in the catering corps. And because I had this working knowledge of the catering, I used to sleep in the lectures and get my ankles tapped and told off. And when it came to the field cooking business, because I was so enthusiastic with scouts, as far as I was concerned, it was just a big scouts camp. So I was quite easy with that. And I also run foul of my instructors in that for being what they considered was a bit laid back, because the thing is that I was conversing with what was happening, whereas the other fellows who hadn't been in the scouts or had any previous catering knowledge, they were finding it hard working, and also the nature of the equipment we had to use.
Where do you think this interest in catering came from?
Well, my parents seemed to think that I had showed an interest as a youngster.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to deny that I ever did not like cooking or getting involved in anything like that. But it wasn't until quite late on that I realised that it wasn't really my forte. And but yet I'm still prepared to do it. But as I found out later on when I came back from FIDS, it wasn't really my forte. And then I decided that, not going to say I'm not going to have anything more to do with it, but not as an occupation.
And what was your first brush with the Antarctic? When did you first begin to realise such a place existed?
Well, I didn't really... Well, I knew of it, but I never put much emphasis on it. But I was a member of an organisation known as TOC-H, which is still flourishing today in some places, but in a completely different guise than what it ever was back in the 1950s. And a gentleman who was a draftsman in the local shipyard came to a meeting one evening and said, "How would you like a job in the Falkland Islands?" Well, to be quite honest, I didn't know where the Falkland Islands were. You see?
So I said, "Well,
hmm?
A lot of people don't.
Yeah, well, don't even know, like, you know." And so anyway, the next thing I know, he came out, it was the next meeting, or whether it was at that meeting, he produced this little bit of paper about the size of a matchbox. And he gave it to me, and I read it through, and I can remember how my actual letter, you know, it's like, "Dear sir, my name is Clive William Pearson. I've got City and Guilds in cooking, waiting and hotel management. And I'd like to apply for the post of General Assistant Cook for, you know, whatever the case may be," you see. And in due course, I got an invitation to go for the interview at 4 Millbank, London. And I went up and went in for the interview. And there were about three, maybe four in front of me. And I duly went in to be met by a sea of faces, which was all the fellows who'd recently come back from that year's trip. And there was Johnny Green and Ray Adie and one or two others there. And one of the first questions they was, "How do you get on with other people?" And I said, "Well, as far as I know, not fairly well." So anyway, they asked me other questions. And I wasn't quite so glib at making facetious remarks in those days, whereas since then I've got this, well, I have been known for making facetious remarks. But anyway, they heard me out, and I went back out and sat down for a few minutes. And then the gentleman, I don't know who he was, but he came out and asked me out into the passageway outside and said, "If we can arrange a medical, can you go now?" So I said, "Yeah, sure, no problem. If I don't catch the Abbas 5 back, I can catch the Abbas 6. And he gave me half a crown for a taxi from Millbank to Harley Street. And I went over there, and this sweet young thing in the office asked me details of who I was and what I was. And they did chest x-rays and one thing and another. And I came back to Dartmouth, and a couple of days later, I got the letter of acceptance. And then I just waited my time, and I was bought what was recommended to buy and disposed of what was recommended to dispose of. And due course, went to Southampton on the Sunday. And I can remember the look on my father's face as I shook his hand and I got on the ferry to go from Dartmouth across to Kingsbury to catch the train. And I said, well, all of us and Dad, see you for Dartmouth Regatta 1960. Well, Dartmouth Regatta is the last Thursday, Friday and Saturday of August. And you could see this lump about as big as a grapefruit in his throat, like, you know, as he swallowed hard on it. So anyway, I stayed the night in Southampton in Tock H, yeah, which one could in those days. And got a taxi the next morning, went down, couldn't see the Biscoe because she's so physically small. She was down under the wall. All you could see was the tops of two masts and just a little bit of the funnel. And Captain Bill was doing his walk up and down the boat deck.
Captain Johnson.
Johnson, yeah. And I leaned over and passed the time of day. I got this wonderful Irish broke back, you're fed. I said, you're fed. Yeah, second bed. And I went back and this lovely little bouncy chappy with blonde curly hair came up to, are you Mr. Pearson? Yes, right. And yeah, went down and then the rest of the lads duly turned up and we sailed about 3 o'clock.
I've got here the advert you answered, haven't I?
Yeah.
In your collection. It is the size of a matchbox, you're quite right.
Yeah.
I've not seen it. May I read it out?
By all means.
Expedition to Antarctica, General Assistant, brackets, Cook, required by Falkland Island Dependency Survey for service in the Antarctic for 30 months under conditions which are a test of character and resource. Commencing salary according to age in the scale of 330, rising to £420 a year, with all found, including clothing and canteen stores. Free passages, liberal leave on full salary. Candidates, preferably single, should have a good experience of cooking. The person selected will leave the UK in October. I've not seen that before.
Yeah.
That's quite remarkable. Did you have any training before you caught the boat?
No.
Training?
Training in respect to water?
Well, dealing with the Antarctic, crevasses.
No. Scientific base, isn't it?
Yes. Argentine Islands you were going to.
Yeah.
But it was still an alien environment, wasn't it?
Yeah, well, you see, the thing was that my local doctor, he had to take out a tooth because they recommended that you have your tooth seen to before you go down. And I'd had problems with mine, and they'd filled it. And even out on the motorcycle, I was getting problems with it. So I wanted it out. But the dentist wasn't very keen because he found he could save it. I said, well, I can't afford to save it. I said, I want it out. And the doc gave me a whiff of something, and they whipped it out. And when I saw the doc before I left, he said, do you know what you're doing? I said, in respect of what? He said, well, you're going away on this expedition, and you've already shown signs of anxiety, you know, about having an anaesthetic. I said, yes. So he said, well, you know, you're going away into the blind, the back and unknown. I said, yeah, I know. I said, but that's reality. I can cope with that. I don't know what reality is, you know, when you have anaesthetic. I said, I've never had anaesthetic before. And apparently he turned out to be, he was one of a group of persons who assessed members of the armed services before they went on sneaky-peaky commando raids and to find out what their mental status was, you see. And I don't know whether he was judging me on that or not. But anyway, as I say, we came back and the gods smiled on us, as you might say.
Yeah. How was the voyage?
Well, if you read the diary, we sailed from Southampton at about 3 p.m. And because the Biscoe's the Biscoe, she rolls on damp grass. I was seasick before we got to the Needles. And I stayed bows under until we got down the bottom of the Bay of Biscay. And I think it's about 2 or 3 pages missing in the diary because of this. And then after that, I think Doc Jones gave me a pill on a couple of occasions when it got really rough. But other than that, yeah, life was good. Yeah. We had to work an hour a day to earn our supernumerary crew money, right, because to transport men in those days, we went down a supernumerary crew, so you were paid a shilling a month, so you had to work an hour a day. And I used to go in the kitchen and do the bread and the rolls for lunch. And I kissed the Dan when I came home. I chipped paint and done other things like that. But it was good. It was good.
Before you set off, did you know which base you were going to go to?
I'm pretty sure I did, yeah, one way or another. Yeah. Probably see somewhere in the paperwork, yeah.
Yeah.
Because that, you see, at the time, 98.999% of the bases of those days were either outdoor activities or something like that. And you did a man a week about, you see. If you had a six-man base, you did every 6 weeks you were a cook. And if you were at a sledging base, you rarely would have very many people in the base at any one time. They'd be out fending for themselves in the field. But F was regarded as a scientific base, so all your personnel were bows under with their own place. So you had a permanent cook. So really, you only did cook's duties once every 10 weeks, which was when it was your Sunday on. And I used to have Sundays off, so a different chappie every Sunday for 10 weeks and then went round again. So it wasn't too formidable.
Out of interest, did you really get Sunday off, or were you hanging around because you didn't know how good the cook?
No, I should stay in bed.
Oh, really? Okay. So you were off limits, were you? You were not available on Sunday?
Well, no, if anybody wanted anything, or I fancied going somewhere. You know, there was a rather splendid arched berg not very far off the base, and we walked up to that, which probably now you'd have to do a feasibility study and a health and safety expert. And you could hear this darn thing creaking and groaning and snicking and one thing and that. And you know, it didn't make it come like this.
How big was it?
Hmm?
How big?
It was quite, there's photographs of it here somewhere, like, yeah.
And, size of a house?
Oh, yeah, it was a lovely thing. You know, I reckon the arch must have been 20 or 30 foot, you know, something like that. And you could hear it, the stress in it all the time, right? Yeah, it was quite a good one. Yeah. And then on another occasion, we walked the whole of the width of Panola Strait and had a little stamp up Mount Tuxen, Cape Tuxen. And yours truly lost his footing and fell about 80 feet back down and stove my ribs in and bent my binoculars the wrong way and damaged my camera. And the lads realised that I wasn't dead. And they waited until I'd recovered enough and we very slowly walked our way back. Fair old width, Panola Strait. Mm. And Doc Jones patched me up. I think I missed a day, if you read in the diary, perhaps. But, as I say, it was good. Yeah.
So you're on the boat heading south.
Yeah.
You call in anywhere on the way south?
Oh, yeah, very much so. We called in at St. Helena and we unloaded some special cargo, and they also unloaded a rather splendid, very large box of matches, because apparently they didn't have any matches, and there were one or two other things which they took advantage of us going out. Whether we did take mail or not, I'm not 100% sure, but I know that I vaguely remember someone saying something about matches. Anyway, we went ashore quite late in the evening, and because the Bisco has only got bulk storage for water, she doesn't create any of her own. Spent the whole of the night with a barge bringing out water for the Bisco. We went ashore and had a stamp about as best we could. And I got back on board in the early hours of the morning and then went back ashore again later in the day, you know, so about 8 o'clock-ish, half past eight. And had a look around and do what they've got in the way of shops and facilities and one thing or another. It was still relying on Union Castle line and things like that in those days, and they did have some facilities, but it was nothing apparently at all like what they have there now, and they're still open for even more. They had these some fabulous motorbikes you'd give your eye teeth for, you know, and they had a coach that must have followed the Ark down the skids, you know. It was that old. It was really, really great to be there and see these items. And when the Union Castle boat came in, we all had to be back on board, because although it's a mooring, apparently it's not practical to have more than one boat there. So then the Hydrographic Survey party, who were with us, who were also going to Base F, they took advantage of do some star fixes or some fixes around St. Helena while we were there. And then we legged it off then, and then we went down to Tristan da Cunha and went ashore. Five of the chaps decided they would like to climb Tristan da Cunha. And I had to walk up and down the village and came back, took some photographs, and went back on board. And it was just coming up to a healthy chop. And then they decided that it wasn't practical to work any more sledge, any more skids. And so they tied up the motorboat and the scow and let them trail after the Biscoe. And there was five chappies left on the island. And then late in the day, they realised that it wasn't going to be practical to stay where we were. No, beg your pardon, we stayed overnight. And it got so bad overnight that the motorboat and the scow broke free and were wrecked. And the motorboat was destroyed completely, and the scow was folded in on itself.
It's all right.
And so we went to sea, and we headed into it for a day or a day and a half. And you could stand on the after rail of the Biscoe, and she would slide down, and you could look over the ship, and she'd bury her nose in and come up the other side. And Bill Johnson must have reckoned that every seventh wave's the biggest. So we waited until she came up on the top of one, and then they did two moves and turned her end for end. And I think she must have listed to some phenomenal list on these two lurches to get her around. And we went back and we hid behind the island for a day or so, at least one day, maybe a bit more. And then we stuck our nose out around and it was quiet again. So we went ashore in the lifeboat, put a tarpaulin over what was left of the scow, and dragged it back towards the ship where they craned it on board. And the fellas that had been left ashore got their wrists slapped by the governor, and they had to go in and sift through all these potatoes that had become all, well, it's sort of incestuous actually, because they know the same stock, same stock, same stock, same stock, same stock. So they mutated, all the potatoes had mutated. So we'd taken down some new stock, and we had on board a new school lady and a new Ministry of Agriculture and his wife and two small children.
For Tristan da Cunha.
For Tristan da Cunha. And they were ashore, and all our furniture and everything else went ashore. And they bagged up all these rough potatoes and loaded them onto us, and we took them down eventually to South Georgia.
So you took the reject potatoes? Didn't you?
Took all the reject potatoes to make sure that they didn't continue this
inbreeding,
yeah. And I take it that the new stock must have come down with us, or new stock was to be added to there just to stop them.
Yeah.
This mutation. And then, I say, we came away from there, went down, went into South Georgia, refueled, watered, had a look around the whaling station, got lots of black and white photographs of that one thing. Then we went into Stromness for a couple of hours. Then we went to Falklands, went in, tied up on government jetty, went ashore, and had a look around the shops and one thing and another. Got an invite to Government House for a party, one thing and another. Then we got a shout that the Shackleton had hit the iceberg. So it's everybody back on board, back to South Georgia, and they brought her in and they put her in the floating dock, but the floating dock wasn't quite man enough to lift her right out, but it got the hole out of the water. So the platers who were there in the dockyard, they measured it up and tack welded a plate over it, but of course she lost her licence, so she wasn't able to go back down in the ice for the second half of the season. So they swapped crews and swapped men and cargo and one thing and another. And I can't remember whether we went back to the Falklands then or whether we went straight on down into the ice. But from there on down, it was base hopping, and till we got to base F very early in January 1958.
Yeah. Did you have a piano on board this boat of yours?
Yeah, well, that came about with Martin. Now, Martin Cyril Smith, M.C. Smith. Now, his relation was, there used to be a rather splendid act on the radio called Duet for Three Hands. and this was Mr. Smith and his wife, who was Miss Selleck, Smith and Selleck. And apparently what happened was that they were on a flight between point A and point B, and he had, an embolism, and he was partially paralysed. So after that, he only used to play his half of the duet with one hand rather than the two because of this business with this partial paralysis. Well, Martin had this wonderful affliction known as perfect pitch, and he was also there as part of the radio sonde team. And the radio sonde team had this wonderful apparatus that could generate sounds, and the different meters of sounds, or the sound waves, were used for plotting the name. And Martin, being a musician, knew what the cycles were for various notes, and having bought the piano and got the engineer on the bass, Keith Bell, to make him a suitable tool, he was able to create a sound on the son machine and tune his piano. And he was great down there. And then later on, when the second year we were down there, Harry Agar bought himself an accordion, and he used to go down and shut himself in the workshop and practice on that rather than annoy everybody up in the lounge. Like,
but Martin Cyril Smith could only still play with one hand, could he?
No. Martin with us.
Yeah.
No, Martin with us. No, he was brilliant. It was his uncle.
Oh, his uncle.
Yes. Cyril Smith and Phyllis Selleck.
Right.
Was the duet for three hands, and Martin Smith, M.C. Smith, who was with us, chappy on the end of the picture.
Yeah.
He was bright as a button. He was, yeah. He was a chemist, apparently.
So where
Martin was?
Where was this piano when you first saw it?
In a cargo net on the end of the pier in Port Stanley.
And had it been in Stanley?
Yeah, Martin bought it from somebody in Port Stanley, having been in conversation with him, probably at somebody's cocktail party or somebody's banyan party.
So it was loaded onto the Bristow?
On the Bristow, yeah, and brought ashore, yeah.
And taken to Argentine?
Yeah.
This was an upright, I presume, wasn't
it? Oh, very much so, yes, yeah. In reasonable state, from what I can remember it, too.
So was that a prompt for parties, singing around the piano and...
Well, no, it just sat down in the workshop. I don't know. We probably did it sometime or other, actually go down there. But most of the party music in that was J.B. Shaw, Jonathan Barry Shaw. Jeff Rose, opposite number. He was guitar man. So, and most of the music, if anything at all, would be J.B. Shaw on the guitar and singing with that. And then they used to pinch all my big pots, the big saucepans and the colanders and all that, and get a bit of balloon material and stretch it over it and make drums and percussion instruments out of that. Balloon skins on saucepans, yeah.
Wooden spoons?
Wooden spoons, and anything like that, you see. Yeah, well, it was all good things, yeah. But because the unfortunate part about, you know, using balloon material for skin, you can never really get it tight, like, you know, because it's always got... some resilience in it, yeah.
Did it sound all right?
Oh, yeah, it sounded right for what we wanted to do. You see, the thing is that you had to have an excuse for a party. Well, we were 11 persons on base F. So you were told as soon as you got there that no one has a birthday in June because that's the midwinter celebrations. So you were then told when you could have your birthday. What you did privately on your birthday was by the board, but you then had 11 birthdays to celebrate. Well, as the ration was one tin of beer a man a fortnight, if you had a birthday a month, you could have two tins of beer. Okay? But then you had your spirit ration as well, which was gin, whiskey and rum. You see, so by bulking that up with a wonderful mixture of what we used to call burgy bits, you could stretch your spirit measure out to go with your two tins of beer.
So and,
go on.
So effectively, it was one party a month, was it?
One party a month, yeah. And birthday cakes were appropriate. And you'd try and make a cake with a design on it or something on it which was appropriate to the person's trade or profession.
And the birthday cake was your responsibility?
Well, very much so, yes.
Yeah.
And... Then, of course, the midwinter one was quite an elaborate, usually an elaborate fair. Some of them were very formal. One of them was in the form of an open book. And we'd also had one of the lads was particularly good at art. I think it was J.B. Shaw. And he designed the midwinter's menu. And he also designed... that's right, he did the midwinter menu. And then in, as you opened it out, he'd drawn caricatures of all the members on the base. And people had habits which you didn't put any emphasis on until they were actually shown you, like you see. But the thing is that when you saw them, you know, pointed out to you, you realised, good Lord, we've been living with that. Like and, of course, he exaggerated all people's different habits. For instance, as I say, if it was my Sunday off, he used to stay in bed. So he depicted me as a bed with a bump in it and a chef's hat perched on top of the bump. That was my Sunday off.
What else did you have time to do in Stanley? Were you shopping for stores or...?
Well, you know, only personal items. Yeah. You know, there was this rather splendid emporium or establishment or whatever it's called, called Don Ross. And Don Ross was sort of like the official FIDS convener. And you would order stuff by the old Morse through your radio operator to Don Ross. And he'd buy all his stuff in. And it would come down on the boats as and when required. But the thing was that he'd go down to FID's office and say, how much credit has Pearson got, or how much credit Smith's got, or how much credit so-and-so's got. And when he'd find out about that, well, he'd buy that and he'd put your name on it, and that would go in the drawer. And then, but he wouldn't buy anything in your name unless he knew that you had credit in the bank. And then at the end of the month, you'd get a box, or whenever the ships came down, you'd get your box from Don Ross with your records and your films and your slide projector or your cine camera or whatever the case may be. It was a good system.
Where was he getting his stuff from? From Argentine?
From probably through the Argentine, something like that. Of course, and then he'd have to rely on the Fitzroy, which legged it up to Monte or Punta Arenas or whatever the case may be. Yeah, because the Fitzroy... She was one a lot older than the Biscuit, I don't think, actually. Well, she was a comparatively new ship, the Fitzroy. Yeah. Because it was only the second trip for the Biscuit ever that I went on. It was the first ever of the Biscuit was in 56 when Prince Philip went down with the Royal Yacht. And there's some rather splendid pictures of the Royal Yacht, actually a bit further down really than what anybody would even dream of letting her go in this day and age. But, yeah, it was great.
So, did he have about a week in Stanley?
Well, must have been. I mean, apart from checking through the time. Yeah, well, he must have been there for quite a few days because we had lots and lots of sacks to fill with aggregate and sand and that from the quarries for the big programme at Base F. And there was other bits and pieces on other bases. We had all those bags to fill.
And you were being kitted out as well, I guess.
Yes, well, very much. Well, you know, one man has to have... two pairs of trousers, two blouses, two jumpers, two something. And it was all these kit bags, you know, and you went in and they said, oh, you're Mr. So-and-so. Take this. It was very similar to when I joined the services. Yeah, great stuff. And most of it was ex-service in any case.
Most of the chaps, you mean, or most of the gear?
Most of the gear. Yeah, you had BD trousers and BD jackets. And, of course, all those lovely mutlucks with the liners and those lovely little... like velvet slippers that you could put on for inside your, and then you had those, they call them vapor barrier Wellingtons. Well, they were good for about minus 30. They were the one. It's like a Wellington inside a Wellington with a vapor barrier. And they were always brilliant pieces of kit, they were.
In what respect?
They keep your feet warm, irrespective.
Right.
Yeah. And then, of course, you had your own ski boots and whatnot. No, I think that's right. FIDS gave you ski boots. We bought your own skis from South Georgia.
Yeah.
And FIDS gave you ski boots. Weird and wonderful things they were. I only got rid of mine about 12 months ago when a chappie came to do the roof insulation, and we had to pull all the stuff out of the roof. And he said, "Cool, what's all them skis, mate?" I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, I collect them." So he had the skis. He said, "You want the boots to go with it?" He was thrilled a bit. Because it's, you know, they use it for window displays and shop fitting and stuff like that.
Yeah. And then he set sail further south. And was that still the Bisco that was?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Because the thing is that then we were the ship, because Shackleton, in the meantime, needless to say, was out of the running because of her damage.
She was heading back to South America, wasn't she, for repairs?
I don't honestly know what happened to her. I know she had a short season because of this unfortunate damage. And as I say, there was quite a bit of swapping of crews and men and one thing and that.
Did you go straight to Argentine Island?
Oh, good Lord, no. We went all around the houses. We went to Signy and O and A, Deception. And, well, you know, we zigzagged all our way. South Orkney, South Shetland. You know, worked our way, you know, all the way down through until we got to F. And if I remember rightly, went to F, but I don't think I got off the first time we went in. I think we went on and done something else and came back and I got off. But I don't think I stayed ashore the first time we went there. But it was only a day or so before I did actually go in and get my feet under the table.
What were your first impressions, Clive?
Well, very impressed. Very impressed. It was infinite. Well, I'd seen other bases further up the line, you know, and seen what they were like. And I made comments about things, you know, talking with other fellows who I was on the boat with, you know, saying, "Well, this could have afforded to have been done, or that could have been afforded to be done." And he looked at it from a different angle to me, going to say, "Well, you know, floor leaves a bit to be desired," you know, something like that in the kitchen, like. And he said to me, "Yeah, no, fair enough, I hear what you're saying, mate, but with all this crew traipsing in and out, like, you know, if you can't blame them for letting it go until we're all out the way, and then they'll do it." Of course, I appreciated it then from that angle. Mm. And, of course, I experienced it myself when I got to where I was going to hide, like.
Yeah. So describe the hut you went to live in on Argentina. Well,
you come in on the jetty and you went up the ramp. And it was a timber building covered with black roofing felt with a bit across the top. We used to call it the horse box, I think, something like that. Anyway, in the middle of it, there was another building at right angles across the building with a square roof as against a pitch roof. And this was the ozone laboratory. Downstairs, if you went in from the jetty end, first on the right was the WC or whatever you want to call it. And then there was another doorway there which went into a small engine room where they had a small engine which supplied as best as could be 24 hours electric for some of the ongoing experiments with the magnetism. On the other side, coming up through, was the engine room with a workshop on the end of it. Then you had the bathroom on the right with a tank of water and a washing machine, etc., etc. And on the left you had the food store, or part of the food store. Then you went up a bit further and on the left you had the surgery where the doc lived, and he had his cabin in there. And on the right you had the sond office. And there's a ladder outside the sond office door that went up to the ozone laboratory over the top, which also went part of the way back in under the roof on each side. But on the depths of the roof on each side were more food stores. Back down in the centre column, the whole of the centre of the building was hollow with a great long corridor all the way through it with coconut matting on it. And then the next one on the left was the bedroom door where you went in and you had... Down to the left, you had three bunks and three beds and four bunks in two pairs. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And on the right, you had three bunks or three beds which made the other 10, the 10 of us all in the bedroom. On the right, you had the lounge. Next to that, you had the weather office. Next to that, you had the radio office. And between, that's right, between the sonde office and the lounge, that's right, between the sonde office and the lounge, was the sonde store. Then the lounge, then the weather office, then the radio office, then the coal shed, and the kitchen on the left, which went back towards the bedroom once you went through the kitchen door for the dining room, and then the kitchen was the area there. Then outside on the landing, you had another piece of apparatus where they could put the sondes, and they would turn and settle down the temperature elements, give them a chance to settle down rather than bring them out of the warm office and take them out and expect them to settle, give them a chance to settle down outside. That was, and then of course there was other buildings which weren't habited, and then there was the big magnetics laboratory, which was as far away as was practical from the base, because they reckoned that when you went down there, it was in scientific interest not to have metal buttons on your flies or anything on your body. So everything was at least more magnetic, more anti-magnetic than magnetic, you know, just to stop interfering with anything. Mm. I was fortunate. Joe Farman took me down there one day. It was quite an experience, actually, with all these wonderful weight-driven clocks and one thing and another. And we had some particularly violent earthquakes in other places in the world while we were down there. And the one at Agadir must have been during 1958. It just knocked the pens off the chart, even down there.
Really?
It was one hell of a thing, that was, yeah.
Was the building in good condition, or was it all a bit tatty?
No, it was in very good state. Very good state, yeah. The felt was in good state as well.
Yeah.
There was a couple of little places, but nothing that was to cause any concern.
Mm.
Nothing at all, no.
Tell me about the kitchen and your facilities there.
Well, you went in, and as I say, it went back to the left as you came in the door, and you had a bench seat, which was, needless to say, lockers with food, etc. in, and a centre table, and the lads would sit around that. And that's, you know, just a dining room. And in the kitchen, you went in, the first thing that greeted you as you came in the door to the kitchen was this rather splendid copper tank, which would be about 2'6" square and about 3, nearly 4 feet high on a stand. And Jerry Cutlin, my predecessor there, I don't know what state it was in when he got there, but he used to brassle this thing and keep it in good state. I continued that as best I could, but people would come in just before it got warm and warm their hands on it, so you were forever fending off, you know, sort of sticky mitts. And then it went away to the right with a worktop, and a worktop all the way down on the right, which overlooked the seal pile and the anemometer tower. Then you had a fully fold-up table on the bit that looked out over towards Indicator Island. And then the stove was on your immediate left, which was SA Ferry with two extra ovens, which we needed for the bread, etc. And that had a device on it. If you get days of calm, you could... a bit of a forced draft by an induction in the flue, which used to help. And Jerry Cutlin used to cheat this by putting a sheet of toilet paper over the reflux valve in the bottom, so it was always stayed shut and it was drawing all the time, actually.
So was it easy to control?
Oh, heavens, yes, yeah, yeah. You had to coax more heat out of it than what you had to suppress.
Yeah.
But it was quite good, because we only had a couple of mishaps. Well, no, really mishaps. I left the bread in on a couple of occasions when I went out in the afternoon. You come back and you had you had a loaf of toast instead of a loaf of bread. And if it was a bit late in the day, you'd ask the lads, you know, whether they were prepared to sort of eat what came out or whether I should supply something else. But because they would eat nearly a loaf of toast in the evenings amongst them, because we had fixed meal times, and but not so bad as being on the boat. You see, when we were on the boat, you had your big meal at lunchtime and sort of just tea and stickies at 5 o'clock or whatever the case may be. But we used to go down later in the evening looking for somewhere to eat, and we got told off by Bill Shorey because we kept eating all the breakfast cereals, you see. And we really hammered his breakfast cereals and he slapped wrist on that.
Well, making bread wasn't a trial then. It was okay making bread.
Oh, heavens, yes. Oh, yes, no problems there.
Yeah. You were taking over your kitchen from Jerry Cutland.
Mm.
Did he pass any tips on to you?
Yeah, he stayed with me for a couple of days, if I remember rightly. At least a couple of days, because he stayed on with the working party. They were building the new generator shed. Because we, apart from Halley Bay, nobody had 24 hours electric. And because of the new scientific programme, it was policy that we had 24-hour electric. So they were going to build a new generator shed. And Jerry stayed over, sleeping rough, in either one of the corridors or up in the roof space of Base F, and helped with the building party for the new generator shed, and also lay out the floor plan for the new store shed.
Mm.
And he would come down the galley and say, if you're going to eat seal, you'll find you do this, that, and the other, and something else. If you're going to have cormorant, you'll find the best thing to do is this. And give me quite a few wrinkles as far as that. Told me what he found worked as far as making the bread was concerned, for quantities, and also for the measuring out of dehydrated vegetables. And there was a measure on the containers that these things came in, and you had pretty well anything that you can think of, you know, the dehydrated. You had two different sorts of dehydrated potatoes that I remember, and you had beans, cabbage, beetroot, rhubarb, and you had bundles of bananas in a tin, which when you opened it looked like chopped firewood. And of course the thing is that if you did it strictly as per the tin, it was so many ounces this and so many ounces that, but after a bit you got that you could work it out by so many British standard handfuls, you see. So then you could just open the tin and grab out 2, 3 or 4 handfuls of potato chips or one thing or another, requisite amount of water, standing on the end of the stove, etc., etc., etc. So Jerry took me a few of those things, and then a lot of the stores supplied were in various people's names. And when you opened a tin of sort of Fred Bloggs's steak and kidney pudding, you could depend that it was more pudding than steak and kidney. So he showed me how to make it fair attack by only using a percentage of the pastry bit that was in the tin, and making it so that it was a bit easier, you know, to eat. Because the thing is, if you tried to eat what was in the tin, you'd be all bulk and no quality. Mm. He gave us more quality and less quantity. And he showed us quite a few wrinkles on that. And what should I say? That was the main thing that he did show me about was the bread and the dehydrated vegetables and stuff. There weren't really a lot he could tell me about the rest, because the rest were all insignificant until you actually came to. And we got on fairly well, what I can remember of it. And then when he turned up his steward on Nabisco on future occasions, I didn't realise that Bill Shorey was so near to retirement or ill health or whatever the case may be, that he dropped out of the running. And I think Jerry stayed on as chief steward on there for several trips afterwards. I don't know honestly how long, but it was.
There's a measurement here called FGH, not BSH.
Yeah. Well, FGH was a effing great handful.
So that's bigger than BSH, was it?
Oh, yes, a BSH was a British standard handful, and that was a man-speak term that was created or tried to be created several years ago by one of the glossy man's mags or something, about so that men could talk amongst themselves to give other fellas some idea of how big the girlfriend's breasts were or something of that nature, you see. You could say, well, she's 1 or 1.5 or 2 BSH, 2 British Standard Handfuls. Yeah. Yeah, it was only a fun item, you see. Helps to buoy it.
You weren't just catering for the 10 fids, were you?
Oh, no, not during the overlap period. No, we had the ones that were outgoing, you know, the past members of F who were outgoing, and there were, I think it was about seven. So you actually stayed beyond on the overlap. Joe Farman, Davy Simmons, they stayed, and we brought in nine others. I didn't mean as we brought in nine others. Anyhow, whatever. The outgoing crowd, they stayed on for the building programme, and Jerry stayed on with them. So we had all them on the books.
Over the summer?
Over the building period, or when they were there. And I don't think they was fitted on the Bisco, because the Bisco would come in and drop materials and whatnot, and then they'd leg it and visit another base or go further south or whatever the case may be, and then come back and pick them up. So there must have been periods there where I was catering for infinitely more than base, habitual base members, that is. Yeah.
Did you have a signature dish?
In what respect? Yeah.
Well, one of your favourite dishes, the one that you were famous for.
Not that I can remember. I just used to do what was ever practical with you know, with what was meant. I can't honestly remember having something. I'll do that tonight, because I'm happy doing that. I can't honestly remember. I know we used to make you could virtually guarantee that, short of anything really nasty happening, whatever went on the table was eaten, which was quite comforting actually. And I don't think they did it out of desperation. I don't think they did it because they needed to. I think, and if they wanted more, I'm pretty sure they felt, you know, they could say, you know, can you bulk it up a bit more, or can you make some extra swords, or is there any chance a bit more meat in the meat pie sort of business? I'm pretty sure, with what had happened over the previous years, that there had been some accumulation that we could have certainly. But I can't ever remember this happening. And also, of course, the beauty of it is, then on an overlap period, you sometimes get a carcass of lamb come ashore as well, or they may have some fresh seal come in. So any meal is another meal, you know, that you don't have to use the rations for, you see, which is great. Yeah.
Were you providing purely what we would call British cuisine, or was some foreign stuff creeping in?
Can't remember anything, but you just made the best of what was available.
But would you have rice and pasta and curry?
When it was practical, do it, yes, yeah.
So you had the spices to make curries?
Well, you probably had curry powder down there as well. Yeah, yeah, already done. Yeah. I can't remember doing a lot of that, but I probably did somewhere.
But it was primarily British cuisine, was
it? Oh, heavens, yeah, yeah.
Sunday lunch type stuff.
Well, as near as practical, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Joe Farman was the base leader, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Your first year.
Yeah.
He became famous, of course, later. But what was he like as a base leader?
Brilliant.
Was he?
He was a very gentle man. And he treated men like he would like to be treated himself, and he trusted men implicitly. And if anything went wrong, I mean, you could see that he took it, you know, he took it hard, like. And he was so dedicated to his work, you know, absolutely dedicated. You know, he'd come back from working on his tired machine, you know, when he was trying to prove these standing waves and something, and he'd come back from that. And he would tell you that he would be putting his hands in the sea to warm them up, because the air temperature was so low while he was working on his apparatus. You know, that's how dedicated he was, you know. And he was a very, very devoted man. Yeah.
Was he a democratic man?
Oh, good Lord, no, nothing like it. You know, he, as I say, he trusted you implicitly, and anything that wanted to be done, he let it be known that it wanted to be done, and people respected him, and it was done. I don't think anybody really riled him, and if they did, it must have been in spite, and I can't see that ever happening.
So there were no big base discussions then, what Joe said went?
No, I don't think it ever even. No, I look, not in my time there, the 12 months that I was there, because he was only there the first year. I can't remember any altercations at all, not with Joe. I had a couple of raised eyebrows with his other physicist, David Simmons. And, you see, David, bless his heart, he was a very quiet man, Davy Symonds was, kept himself very much to himself. And he would be on dining room duty sort of business, you see, and he'd quietly come in about 10 minutes to 12 or 10 minutes to 1, whenever lunchtime was going to be. And he'd quietly slip in and he'd lay out the knives and forks and one thing and another. And he'd come up to me and he'd say, "Yim, how long?" You see? And you look at what was on the stove and say, "Well, give us a couple of minutes yet, David," like you say. And he must have stood outside the door and done this, like you see. And he'd come back and he said, "You're right." So I said, "Well, what's up?" He said, "Well, you should be a couple of minutes at the business." And the thing was, he meant it, you see. Meaning, whereas to the vast majority of people, a couple of minutes would be, "Well, give us a bit of slack, you know, sort of, give us a short period of time." And then there was another instance where he took me literally, was he had this pair of trousers, the Army BD trousers, and all the nap had gone off them. And he wore them, and then they were, well, not quite self-parking, you know. And he wanted to dispose of them, you see. So me, as a wind-up, says, "That's all right, Dave." I said, "When you go, I said, I'll give you 30 bob for him." He said, "Well, £1.10 back then was a lot of money." The thing was that when he come the day before he went, he brought these trousers back and honestly expected me to give me 30 bob for them. "You got scratched, David?" I said, "Do you recognise a wind-up when you see it?" And, you know, and I think David was a bit choked on that.
Was there lots of winding up going on that base?
Oh, heavens, yes. Oh, right, it was fun. It was fun. One of the biggest winds, I don't know whether you've heard from anybody else about the ongoing between J.B. Shaw and Jeff Rowe.
Go on.
Well, Jeff had the last bunk, the last bed on my side of the bus now, and J.B. Shaw had the top bunk. And J.B. used to snore, or snuffle, or one thing and another, you see. So there was, yeah, I know, I couldn't really sleep last night, you know, it was all bloody snuffling as much as much. This is Jeffrey and Bod. They were bosom pals from school. You know, they both came down from Glossop. And this was name. So he got this bamboo cane from somewhere and got it to rest up between the back of the bunks and down by his bed, you see. And he sort of rattled this lot to disturb J.B. Shaw, you see, to get him to change his position and thus, you know, stop snuffling from one thing and another. And it's worked for a couple of occasions. And I don't know whether he actually touched him or caused him an injury or not. Well, Bud Shaw thought, "Well, I'll get my own back on this," you see. So he put either honey or jam on this bit of stick, like you say. Because, unbeknown to himself, he went to sleep, you see, and needless to say, during the course of his sleeping, he either snuffled or snored again, you know. Jeff grabs his bit of stick, and he had a handful of honey or jam, you see, which didn't go down well, because then he changed that, and that led to a bit of a strained relationship. But anyway, they got over it. When we lost Jeffrey, he died in a motorcycle accident in Australia or New Zealand, where he was living about 2 or 3 years ago, or in the fairly recent past, and not the stupid past. And J.B. Shaw wrote up a fabulous write-up in our...
An obit in the Bass magazine.
Hmm?
An obit in the Bass magazine, yeah.
Yeah, and he's got all the saga of the old jam on the stick job in there. It really was quite something, that was, yeah.
There's another saga concerning brown sauce and rice pudding.
Yeah, well, that was in the dining room one night. Somebody put brown sauce in somebody's rice pudding. And that, for some reason, that wasn't regarded as a funny either. I never really knew what happened about that, but I know when it actually occurred, it wasn't considered funny.
So some of the practical jokes would backfire, would they?
Well, that was the only one that I think that backfired. I don't know whether it led to a great period of not speaking to anybody or anything, but that was one of the occasions which was serious, as you might say. Mm. The other one just remained as a tiff between Barry, between Bodshaw and Jeffrey, but I think this other one, you know, did strike a little bit nearer home for whoever was concerned. Yeah.
As the cook, were you aware of the scientific work that was going on?
Oh, very much so, yeah. I used to try and get involved if I could.
In what way?
Well, when you were out, they had all these instruments out, and during certain types of weather, you get frost flowers growing on their instruments, you see. And if you were in that neck of the woods, you could lean over and brush the frost flowers off, because they would increase the surface area over what they were trying to monitor. And it helped to keep the true picture of what was happening. And then they had another device which measured the amount of reflected radiation, and that had an accelerator on it, so that it was always at a constant temp, with this little fan at the back, and the fan used to choke up because it used to accumulate rheumatoid, and you could just go out, if you were going out, going past it, you could waggle your ski gloves in front of it and knock off the frost crystals and little things like that. And you could do that, or you could give Joe a hand with his tide gauges, because he was really heartfelt set. The actual tube that went down and moved up and down with the floats and that was filled with diesel or heavy oil, because that wouldn't freeze. Whereas if the tide was in there, it would be more sluggish, because although the sea would freeze down there about -4, -5, something like that, starting to get, and it wouldn't give you a true reading because it was thinner. Whereas if it was diesel, it wouldn't coagulate to the same extent. And I helped, you know, where and when, and also used to help Keith Bell with the engines, as and when, and also Brian Giles, him and Keith. When Keith Bell became bass leader in the second year, he asked Brian Giles to be second Dickie, and they'd been close since we got there. They were, you know, those two was mates, and Jeffrey and Bob was mates, and I teamed up for the first 12 months with Malcolm Hunt, who later went on to go on sledging, came away from the Met Office, and I was very close with Martin. I was close with everybody one way or another, but you know, you just seem to spend a bit more time with other people than the rest of them.
Was there much opportunity for sledging at
Who was it who went? I think it was Keith Bell and Martin Smith went off for a couple of days out on Panola Strait. I don't know whether they had somewhere where they actually intended to go, or whether they just went out to see what life was like living out of a sledge box in a tent sort of business. Probably got some record somewhere in the diary of it. But I know when they came back, it looked like someone had hit the radio set they took with them. It looked like somebody had hit it with a hammer, because it was rather strange plastic material that had been on the leads, etc. And they'd moved these at about minus Lord knows what else. And of course, all this darn stuff had shattered. And of course, bringing it back into the base out, it was quite a different story. And they sledged up to the Argentinian base at the bottom of the Lemaire Channel on another occasion, and issued the protest note with one hand and took the vino with the other, like, as one does.
Was this dog sledging or man hauling?
Man hauling, yeah.
But you did have a couple of dogs, didn't
we? We had three, four, and we lost one. You see, we had to keep the two bitches chained up because they would fight. But well, four of them was chained up to start off with, but when it come to the end and we lost one, the other dog used to run free, but he had arthritis and he wasn't much good to the girls, unfortunately. And when we moved in, so the last of the pups moved out that had been bred at F, Lobo and Nymph. I think it's like Lobo and Nymph were those two that went out. And we had Greta in because she'd had intercourse with an Archie dog at Hope Bay, and they didn't know if she'd had a VD, and they didn't want her to breed, so they brought her down to us. And Malcolm Hunt took her under his wing, and purged her in one thing and another. And she was quite some pet, she was. And we used to give her a little sledge if we were working cargo. And you put a box about 60, 70 pounds on a little sledge, and she'd steam off with this and run up with the lads, you know, just haul it up the beach or up to wherever we were going. And she got away from us, and she was having a set to with Jenny. And I'm trying to break this up by bashing them with my ski gloves. So they stopped fighting. She turned round, bit a lump out the inside of her leg, and carried on with the fight. In other words, mind your own.